The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 637 for Sunday, December 25th, 2016.
Wow. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, your tips, and your cool stuff found, with the goal being for each of us to learn at least four new things each and every time we get together. For those of you that celebrate, Merry Christmas today. Our sponsors for this episode include Power Photos from Fat Cat Software at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. We'll talk more about that shortly here. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here, Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
How goes it, Mr. Braun?
Yeah, it's going.
Good. Good. Did you like that alternate intro?
Yeah. Where'd that? What was that?
Robert Hazelrig made that for us a number of years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. So I figured I'd pull it out. We had some weird problems starting the show, and so we figured we'd go kind of off the beaten path. Merry Christmas, Mr. Braun.
Or whatever you celebrate.
No. I know you celebrate Christmas, so I'm telling you Merry Christmas.
Okay.
It's polite to offer something in return.
What do you want? What do you want?
Oh, my gosh. All right. Let's go to Simon here. All right. We have a bunch of quick tips for you today. So we'll start with a couple of those, and then we've got some questions, and we'll go from there. Simon says, I may have a tip. I always save screenshots and rubbish to the desktop each week I need to clean them up. While doing my cleanup this week, I selected several JPEGs and accidentally pressed Command Return, and lo and behold, I got a single pop-up showing all the thumbnails and all like in one little quick view window, if you will. He says it saved him time arrow keying through them all to see if any of them were needed. Very cool stuff. And I test it and it works. Nice little trick. Did you have any idea you could do this?
I love these happy accidents.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good. I like the happy accidents. You all right today, Mr. Braun? You seem a little. Did Santa not bring you what you wanted? I should say we are, as we did last week, we're recording the show on Friday. So technically today is Festivus. Well, John and I are here, but for you, it's actually whatever day you're listening to it. We'll release it on the 25th, because just to keep with our normally scheduled programming. But all good, Mr. Braun? Yeah.
I hope I get what I asked for.
Good. All right. I hope you did too. All right. Todd has a nice little tip for us. He says, in Photos for Mac, create, and he credits Allison Sheridan at podfeet.com for this, and we'll put a link to her blog post explaining it in the show notes, of course. But he says, in Photos for Mac, create a smart folder to find all the photos that aren't in any album. He says, and why it's useful. I imported a new big batch of photos from my phone. While in the last import zone, I moved a handful of selected photos into albums. Then I wanted to delete the rest. But since photos can be in multiple albums and views, I couldn't figure out how to select only the photos that had not been moved into albums. Alas, a quick Google search found that tip from Allison of the Nozilla Cast. So thank you, Todd, and thank you, Allison, for that. Good stuff. I like little tips like that with photos. I wish it was always that easy to do whatever we need to do with photos, because it's sometimes limited, but that's okay. That's okay. It's all good. Any thoughts on that one, John, before we move on?
No, I like those smart albums.
Yeah, same. It's good stuff. All right. Moving on to Everett, and we hope that we fixed the little static issues that we had. And if we haven't, we're about to find out, because Everett's tip is from Everett.
Hello, John, Dave, and sometimes Pilot Pete. I know you guys were talking about in a recent episode Xfinity's free Wi-Fi to the current customers, and I found that their encrypted Wi-Fi network, you don't have to use their profile to log into it. All you need is a current Xfinity username and password, and then it will let you on. It has somehow linked their customer database and sign-ons to its WPA encryption. So I don't know how they're doing that, whether it sends the computer a packet to communicate securely or how exactly it's doing it, but that's how I'm able to get on. And I can tell it to forget the other Xfinity, quote, unsecure networks. Thanks, and I hope you have a great day.
I like this tip. Because I've had far more, security aside, I've had far more success with the secure Xfinity in all caps network than I have with the lowercase Xfinity Wi-Fi or even the cable Wi-Fi network that are also part of that profile. So I like this. So, yeah, what they're probably doing is something akin to what I understand Radius logins to do, where you're using a username and password to connect to Wi-Fi instead of just a password. And even some home routers, like higher end home routers, will let you do, you know, specific users, which is nice, especially in like a corporate environment where you let somebody go, you want to terminate their access to the Wi-Fi, but not everyone else's. And you don't want to have to send around an email with just one password. So I'm sure that Comcast, if they're not using Radius, they're using something else to do all that. Enterprise stuff. In fact, Andy in the chat room, Will Run for Fun, says that is how WPA2 Enterprise works. The credentials are in the profile. So there you go. Thank you. And our chat room, of course, at mattgeekgab.com/stream, keeping us accurate and up to date. Very much appreciated. Good stuff. Finally, a tip from Gray today, because why not? He says, you may have already learned this, but it is possible to sign into iCloud on an iOS device. He says the MacMost video podcast on November 9th shows the page brought up in Safari and iOS can be bypassed. So when you launch, when you go to iCloud.com on your iPhone, you just get a page that says, you know, go to the settings app to set it up, open Find My iPhone or open Find My Friends. And then you can check your activation lock status, too. But you can't actually hit the iCloud web interface. You're sort of directed away from that. But if you touch the action icon and slide your choices to the left, the last one is Request Desktop Site. Touch that and voila, as they say in French class, you can then access the inbox to mark calendar spam as spam right from your iPhone. And that's a handy little thing, not just for iCloud, although obviously it serves a great purpose there. But for just about anything, you can go and request the desktop version of the site if the mobile version is not to your liking. So thanks very much for that, Gray. Good stuff. Any thoughts on that, John?
Nice.
I think so.
Yeah, I get a special little page here.
Huh. Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, John. Moving on to Larry. He says, I received an email from Dropbox regarding the public folder and how it will be permanently eliminated. He says this was a big part of his workflow as a Dropbox Pro customer. And he's right. The public folder has been going away in stages, or at least the old functionality of the public folder has been going away in stages. He says, he runs a company selling things, and he says, I have a link that they can click to and read charts, which show all the things that he needs them to see. He says, and he just puts a link in his email. And the nice part is when they click this link, they're going to a file that's hosted on his Dropbox public folder. And he just gets they get in this case, the raw PDF right there in their web browser. When Dropbox took the public folder away from free accounts, and now what they're doing with pro accounts is no longer can you treat the Dropbox public folder as just another resource on the web. You can't link to, like, people would use it for forum posts or whatever. If you wanted to put an image up in a forum post and you had to host it separately, you just put it in your Dropbox public folder and put a link to it. No longer does it work that way. Now, when you go and visit something in your Dropbox public folder or any folder where you share a public link to the document, you get it framed within a Dropbox website. So you can't just embed these things. Now, for Larry's usage, it might still work because he's just showing people a PDF. So instead of them linking to just the raw PDF, now they would see the PDF kind of in Dropbox's own PDF viewer interface. So it might still work for you. But if that doesn't work for you, either for Larry or for any of you, there are alternatives. Now, they aren't free, but neither is the current implementation of Dropbox's public folder. You have to pay for that. So I would look at, honestly, I would look at an Amazon S3 account. They're very inexpensive, especially for what we're talking about here, low bandwidth stuff. I mean, we're talking, you know, dollars per month, maybe even dollars per year, depending on how much you use. So so I think that's a place I would go with this. But I'm curious, John, have you gone through any of this?
I just right-clicked on one of the files I have in my public folder and pasted it in my browser, and it was a JPEG, and it brought up the JPEG. So
is it a JPEG in your, like, in a Dropbox frame, or is it just the raw JPEG?
It's just the raw JPEG.
All right. Well, that's going away. You don't get to do that anymore. Right. Yeah. So you will start getting it in frames. But I believe there's a little bit of time. I think it's at some point in 2017 where that goes away. But Amazon S3 might be the and you might even be able to get away with a free Amazon S3 account, at least for a year, depending on the amount of bandwidth that you're going to use and storage. But very, very inexpensive way to go. And I think we can trust that Amazon's going to be around for a little while. I mean, you never know. But I don't know. I think it's fair to say. Any other thoughts on alternatives for this, John? I know you use a bunch of different cloud services, so I'm just curious if you've seen this available elsewhere.
Yeah, I'll peruse my I got a OneDrive account, Google Drive, Dropbox. I think that's about it.
All right.
Well, iCloud Drive, of course. Though I don't, of course, believe they offer any
public
functionality.
Well, they do, but just not to solve Larry's problem. Yeah. Mm. All right, cool. Moving on to Phil. Phil asks, I was a longtime user of ProXPN and now am trying a free TunnelBear account. I also see there are a lot of browser plugins that offer a VPN just within the browser. Chrome has a .vpn plugin, as does Opera's developer version. What's the biggest difference from these? He says, from what I can see, the first two allow that anything you do to be anonymous, and the ones in the browser only allow the content in the browser to be tunneled through the VPN. And that's exactly right, Phil. With a system-wide VPN like ProXPN or TunnelBear, or even one that you set up on your own, or a corporate VPN or anything like that, as long as it's system-wide, you are going to you have the choice, actually. When you set up a VPN in system preferences in network, you can tell it whether or not you want. If you go into the advanced section, you can say send all traffic over VPN connection. If you check that, then it does exactly what you would expect. All of your traffic is tunneled through the VPN. If you don't check it, then only traffic to the network segment that matches the IP subnet of the VPN will be sent there. And that can be handy, too. If, for example, you need VPN access in order to get to your company's database or something like that. But, you know, you're working in an otherwise trusted environment, right? Let's say you're at your home and you trust it there, or even a second location of the company, and you just need to tunnel through to this other one to get to a resource. That can make things a little more efficient. That way you're not tunneling all your traffic through the VPN. But for security and privacy, you would want to check that box in most cases and do it. You got the noisy chair today, John. With an in-browser VPN, That's a little bit different. As you noted, it just puts the traffic inside the browser across. And unfortunately, there's no in-browser VPN plugin for Safari that I found, or extension, I should say. But in Chrome, you can find .vpn and you can find some others. And these are available for free, which is kind of cool if you don't want to start tunneling the majority of your traffic across a VPN, but you do want to tunnel your web browsing traffic. There's various reasons for this. It just depends on what you want secure or even hidden, right? Sometimes you don't mind if people sniffing your network traffic know what mail server you connect to, but you want your browsing history to be private or not, subject to the limitations of your network, right? If you've got something that limits where you can go on the network that you're on, well, using a VPN typically bypasses that entirely, unless the VPN is blocked by the network administrator too. So thoughts about any of this, John?
I used something a long time ago, Juniper, and I think it was a Java plugin or some sort of browser plugin.
Huh.
But the point you bring up is good, too, is that I do remember, and also I use the Cisco product sometime. It gets kind of interesting if you want to access both VPN resources and local resources. I actually remember this from the Cisco VPN software. There was actually a checkbox where you could say allow access to local resources as well.
Sure.
I think the default was no, but say you wanted to, access your corporate network but print something on your printer, you would have to dig into the software and find that setting to allow that scenario.
Right. Right. Cool. Yeah. VPN can be a handy thing. I always tend to keep one going or ready to go, not just for security, but mostly for when I need, when I'm on some network that's just getting in my way. And then it's like, you know what, let me just turn on the VPN and tunnel out of here and I'm good to go. And I've told the story on the show before where it was a year or two ago, I was showing my son, we were testing Dabuki, right, to see what traffic was available, what traffic was visible from the local network. Like, could you see where someone was connecting? And sure enough, you could easily, right? It's like, oh, interesting. So I fired up a VPN and did it, and you couldn't see. All you could see was this one device had a connection to a VPN. What's going on over there, Mr. Braun?
And I just tightened the bolts on this thing, too.
Man.
I don't know.
I mean, it's like maybe it's the new audio setup here I have. I have a much cleaner signal to you, but it's like the noisiest chair in the world today. But I showed this to my son. I was like, yeah, it worked with the VPN. And then he came home from school the next day and said, hey, can you set me up with a VPN account here at the house? I'm like, yeah, of course. He said, yeah, because they don't let us get on Instagram or anything like that. They block all that with the school network. He says, but I'm pretty sure with the VPN, they couldn't block that. Like, yeah, you're absolutely right, kiddo. Sure enough, works great. So, and actually, my kids aren't alone. A lot of the kids at school use VPN like Tunnel Bear or something like that to get around and do the stuff. I would. And I think that's good for the kids to think about it. That's good stuff. Anyway, that's what I got. You got anything else on this, John?
No, not really.
Okay.
We've had quite a bit of VPN talk.
Yeah. 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 But this was a little bit different. I honestly had never thought about it as a browser plugin before, but it works. I tried it. I tried that .vpn plugin in Chrome and it worked great. Really well. It's good stuff. You ready for me to talk about our sponsor, John?
Absolutely.
May I? Awesome.
You may.
Our sponsor for this episode, and it's just one for our Christmas episode here, so we get to take a little time with them, is Fat Cat Software at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. The folks at Fat Cat have been making software to enhance Apple's photo management offerings for years, and their current product called Power Photos is the toolbox you need if you use Photos on your Mac. Previously, they made iPhoto Library Manager for iPhoto. same general concept. Photos is great. It lets you manage your things. It's totally tied in with the system. There's a lot of reasons to use it. One of the reasons against using it is that its functionality sort of hits a wall at times. That's where Power Photos comes in. It allows you to do things that Photos just doesn't, and yet you still get to have all your it's a cake and eat it too scenario is exactly what it is. So you can merge multiple photos libraries together. You can eliminate duplicate photos. You can use it to not just merge multiple libraries, but manage multiple libraries. It has its own photo browser, so you can do searching. You can do list view of your photos, copy photos back and forth between two different libraries. You can split up one library into pieces. So if you get to the point, it's the end of the year, and you're like, hey, you know what? I've got photos in my library going all the way back to, you know, 2000. I don't want to have all of this on one computer. Maybe you're on an older Mac and it's getting a little slower. Chop up the library. Say, okay, you know, let's cut it off. Let's say I've got one library that goes up through 2011, and then I'll have one 2012 through 2016. Okay, great. You know, and you can do that, and then you can just bounce between them. It's easy. Very, very easy. And Photos will allow you to open different libraries just by holding the Option key. Power Photos lets you create those alternate libraries and manage the photos that you want to move between the two. That's something that Photos simply will not do. Really makes that life super, super easy. Here's the bonus. If you still happen to have an older machine with iPhoto, you probably still want iPhoto Library Manager. The good news is when you buy Power Photos, it's a bundle license. You get both. That's how it works. Even better, coupon code MGG saves you 20% off the purchase of that bundle license. So go to fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. That lets them know that we sent you. And then when you're ready to buy, coupon code MGG saves you 20%. So you got to check it out. Our thanks to the folks at Fat Cat Software and Power Photos for sponsoring this episode. All right, John, let's go to Douglas. Let's do this here. Douglas says, I have a question on Bluetooth earbuds. It's timely, given all the attention to AirPods and the like, John, and your chair, which we can hear through our Bluetooth earbuds. For a couple of years, I've been using the Jaybird Bluebuds Bluetooth earbuds, and they're the type that are connected with a cord to each other. I have been very happy with them. Recently, I purchased a couple of inexpensive single ear earbuds to use for listening to podcasts during my train commute. Let me say that I am in agreement with you. Totally wireless is amazing. It truly is. He says, here's my question. When watching video on my iPhone 7 with the Jaybird Bluebuds, and the audio and video are in perfect sync. However, when I watch the same file using one of the single ear earbuds that I recently got, the audio lags behind the video. Both single ear earbuds are Bluetooth 4.1, and one of them is Bluetooth 4.1 plus EDR. Why is it in sync with the Bluebuds and not with the single ear earbuds when all of them are Bluetooth? Is there a difference on the receiving end? And if so, how do I know whether or not this will be the case prior to purchase? It's a good question. So here's the deal. Bluetooth audio is always sent compressed, right? I mean, it has to, it's not just sent in its raw form. It's compressed down, it's sent over to the Bluetooth earbud, it's decompressed, and then, of course, inside the earbud, converted from digital to analog, because our ears are still remain analog devices. So that process will take some amount of time. Now, it can be done in an amount of time that is imperceptible to the human ear. Anything below, I don't know, what is it? Is it 20 milliseconds or 30 milliseconds is basically imperceptible. And certainly in terms of sync between audio and video, that's going to work out just fine. Anything larger than that, even especially things significantly larger, like if it's 200 milliseconds, you're going to notice. So it depends on how it's all wired. But some Bluetooth earbuds also will do some buffering so that they can recover from a momentary glitch, because Bluetooth is very susceptible to interference. So anything where it requires a great sync, you basically are trading the potential for skips for the guarantee of a delay, right? And that's just sort of how Bluetooth works. So maybe these single ear earbuds are actually all made by the same vendor, and that vendor has chosen to do some buffering or has some slow processing in the chain somewhere along the line. But you just have to test them. That's all. Any thoughts? I've done some testing, John. I want to actually talk about, I've tested a bunch of AirPods alternatives for folks here, that we'll talk about in a minute, but any thoughts on this before we get into that?
I'm not really a Bluetooth audio type of guy, to tell you the truth.
I would say, that in 2017, I mean, we've seen it really, 2016 has been the year of wireless, truly wireless, cordless earbuds. I think we're going to see even more of that now that Apple has legitimized that market. And as I've said, it's totally blissful. And now I'm hearing an echo from you, John. Oh,
well, that's because I took my headphones off. Because I was looking, I wanted to get the model number. So these are the S400BT from JBL. And I tried the Bluetooth audio option. And actually, to your point, but I wasn't really happy with it because I ran into the interference thing. I'm sitting near my Wi-Fi and all that stuff. And it wasn't a very pleasant experience. So I actually opted to wire it into my soundboard.
Well, for doing a podcast, you almost, almost certainly want, I don't know, frog in my throat, squeak in your chair, frog in my throat. We'll make it. You certainly want wired. You don't want any delay because it can be weird talking and hearing yourself on a mild delay. Unless you're really used to it, it can slow you down. Although for me, that's a good thing. Slow me down.
I don't know if the well, you asked the question about EDR. I don't know if that has anything to do with the delay. EDR is enhanced data rate, and that I think allows your Bluetooth stream to go, I think, up to 2 megabits a second or something.
Okay.
I don't know if that causes or prevents a delay or not.
Right. I honestly don't know if it matters. I don't think it does, but I think it just allows faster data throughput. So in terms of, the AirPods are out. I actually haven't tested the AirPods. I asked Apple if they wanted to be involved in this little roundup that we were doing today, and they said no. So it's like, okay, that's fine. But I will say this about the AirPods, because I've talked to quite a few people that have them, specifically about the delay that Douglas is talking about here and all of that. And everyone that I've talked with, and I've probably talked with 15 people that have AirPods, not a single one has reported any perceptible delay when watching videos or anything like that. Even a Skype chat, Allison Sheridan. So the second call out in the same episode here, she and Steve, her husband, did a Skype chat and testing specifically for this for us. And no, nothing perceived. So they're obviously doing something right. Now, the AirPods are connecting both earpieces directly to the phone or to the Mac. They are not doing what most of the other ones do, which is the stereo ones, where one connects and then that connects to the other one, which introduces a second layer of delays. And my, I've been going back and forth on which one's my current favorite, but I think the ear-in still sits at the top of my list. It has come down in price since we first talked about it. Instead of it being $299, it's now $199. The ear-in is just a pair of wireless earbuds. It doesn't do any speakerphone. It doesn't do anything like that. And it does have an intentional delay built into it. So using it for watching video is not recommended. You've got about a 150 millisecond lag built into it. And the reason is not just skip protection and buffering, but to make sure that the two ears are in perfect sync. If they are not, you will start to get this thing where, like, the middle of the stereo audio signal starts to waver back and forth. Oftentimes the singer's voice is the thing that's panned dead center, And so you'll get this weird feeling sometimes if people don't do this, where the singer's sort of wavering back and forth if there's any variance in the latency. So Erin intentionally has engineered around that by building in a buffer and a delay to make sure everything stays in sync. And the cost of that is it's not built for watching video. But they do sound amazing when you're listening to music. Absolutely my favorites for that at the moment. And I use it all the time when I'm playing my drums. They can get loud enough and they seal my ear well enough to do that. So we'll put links to all this stuff in the show notes. A new one that I haven't really talked much about, but am very interested in is the Braggy Dash. Now, the Dash retail is $299. You can get it on Amazon for about $249. The Braggy Dash is a set of stereo earbuds, but much more than that. They've got a speakerphone in them. They've got a 4 gig chip in them, so you can load music onto them. You have to plug it in USB it's got a little charging case. And you plug the charging case in USB, and then you can copy stuff to the folder on these things. So you don't need your iPhone or your watch with you or anything. It's got a gyroscope in it. It's got a heart rate monitor. It's built and it'll talk to HealthKit and all of that. It'll do your step counting. It can, track calories. They're waterproof, so it can track your pool laps. I mean, it's pretty crazy what they've done with this thing. It's an interesting, it's a fairly comfortable earbud. I've had a little trouble getting the left one to seal. I'm not quite sure why, to be honest. The right one seals fine for me. They've got different sizes and all of that of like these ear tips, but really an interesting thing. Have you heard of the Braggy Dash at all, John?
No.
Okay. That's great. So, they've just like Erin, it has an app that has some control. Actually, the Braggy Dash has quite a bit more control than the Erin. So, if you're a runner or a swimmer, these are really built for you. But they do sound good. They sound wise. My only complaint is that they are very limited in volume. You can only crank the volume up to a certain point, and that's maybe 60%, maybe 70% of maximum. Then you have to launch their app to go above that. But once you go back down, you can't go above it again. And I've found for some scenarios, it's not quite loud enough. It does have a cool thing though, John, called transparency mode. They have a little microphone. In fact, it is. It's got to be a little microphone in each ear. And you can turn on transparency mode so that even though the earbuds seal your ears, you get to hear out like sound from around you bleeding in. So if you want to listen to music while you're running or whatever, you can do that and still hear cars coming by or even people talking with you. And you can configure it so that it turns this on and off when you pause your music. So you can be kind of in isolated world while you're listening to music, perhaps on a plane. And then when you stop, you just tap the side of the earbud. It's got it's got touch sensors on either earbud. You just tap one of them, pauses the music. And then it turns on transparency mode if you have it set that way so that you can hear and you don't have to pop the thing out of your ear or anything like that. It's pretty cool what they're doing with it. They've got they call that the Dash. They've got something coming out soon. I think you can pre-order it. It's called the Headphone, and it's kind of the same concept, but it's not waterproof. It doesn't have the internal storage. It doesn't have, a lot of that stuff, but it's $149 is their price on that. So anyway, it's something to think about. And then two others, I've mentioned them on the show before, along with the Erin, which is why I won't spend a whole lot of time on them. But I have gotten the opportunity to test the two that were mentioned by you folks, the Smart Omi Boots and the Rokin BitCharge. The Boots are the least expensive that I've tested at $76. They have no charging case. I mean, they have a case that charges, but it has no battery in it. So you just have to plug in either to your computer or you could plug into an external battery. But no built-in portable way of charging. But that helps bring the cost down. And they sound okay. Though the Braggies have no perceptible lag when listening to music and watching videos. So that's a good sign with those. The The Smart Omi boots do have a little bit of lag with the video, and they do it for the same reason to make sure that the music listening is, you know, dead center. Audio quality wise, the Smart Omi boots are probably the worst of the four, but it's not terrible. If you're not a maniac about audio quality like me, you might not even notice. So definitely worth considering, and fairly comfortable. They kind of just fit in the ear and they're good. And then the Rokin Bit Charge for $129 does have a battery built in, no perceptible delay, decent audio quality. Again, not audiophile level, but and not on par with the Dash or the Earin, but decent audio quality. So we'll put links to all those things in the show notes. So if you didn't get AirPods for your holiday gifting, if you didn't find them under the Christmas tree or wherever that was, or you're just not interested in the AirPods for whatever reason, you got some other options here. So there you go. Any thoughts on this, John?
No, I may check out those headphones.
Which headphones?
That you mentioned. Didn't you mention that Braggy is going to do some headphones?
Oh, yeah, Braggy's doing. Yeah, it's called. Yeah, that's right. They call it the headphone. That's right. Yeah.
The headphones.
No. The headphone.
The headphone.
It is stereo, which is now going to be confusing, but it is. Yeah. Yeah. Why don't you? John, let's do something a little bit different. You and I both recently have headed into the world, and I'm not going to say Alexa, and we're going to try not to say that word in case anyone else has one of these units. So we'll call it Amazon. So you and I both have these Echo based devices in our home. We have the Echo Dots, I believe, is what we each got. We each have. And we've been playing with it. So talk about some of the fun stuff you've been doing with your Echo unit.
So one of the first things, so what you can do is you can, the way to add functionality to this device is that it has skills. And what thrilled me to death, Dave, was the number of things that it interfaces to that I can't do with the Apple Echo system.
Yeah.
So one of the first, which I know thrilled you anytime you come over here, so I have these Wink bulbs, or I got the starter kit. So it's called a Link Hub, which allegedly you can only use to control light bulbs, but I found that I can see other devices. In the past, the only way to manipulate that was to run an iOS app, which I found kind of annoying. There was no web interface, no way to do it easily from a Mac or a PC. It was just an iOS app, and I'm like, well, that's lame. Well, all of a sudden, I can now add a skill to Wink, and basically all I have to do is go in the room and I say, Alexa, turn on the lights.
No, you don't. Nope.
Sorry.
Can't say that word.
Well, you don't have, you can call her different things too.
Right.
So we're not going to wake everybody's up, but
we just woke most of them up.
But I can say, turn on the lights. Or, now this is the fun part too. Now it integrates with the app. So what I found interesting was that when I looked at the Wink application, it would show, hey, you know, I got an instruction from this other thing.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, well, that's neat. I'm like, huh, you know what? When the request comes into their app, it lists a percentage. I wonder if I can do that. And yes, you can. So I can say, turn on the lights at 10%.
Oh,
bring them
nice.
On at 10%. Or I can up or down the brightness of the bulbs. So that's kind of fun.
Now, that's not a guarantee with every skill. It depends on what the author of the skill has baked into it. And you'll find that sometimes there's a third party or even freely available sort of almost open source skill that will have way more functionality than the official one from the manufacturer, because it's built by the users as opposed to, you know, the manufacturer who is just sort of punching the ticket. Sometimes some manufacturers do a great job, but some not so much. Yeah.
Yeah. One that didn't thrill me. So I got this smart AC control and they have an interface to it, but they don't let me do what I'd like to do. So the interesting thing about the smart AC control from Tato, I'm not sure the right pronunciation, but So you can tell it to turn it on and off and give it, I guess, the degrees that you want it at. But the thing is, the device also, and now this is what I think on the one hand is a well-engineered device, is you can access it either through an app or through a web interface if you sign in.
You're talking about the...
The smart AC control.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Tato.
Sure.
They do have a skill, and what disappoints me, though, so if you run the app, in addition to being able to control your AC with the IR, it also shows you the temperature and the humidity, which it kind of has to know to do its thing.
Sure.
The problem is, I would have expected to be able to find that information out, but apparently they didn't put a skill or a phrase or whatever the proper term is for me to get that information. Because I said, well, you know, tell me what the temperature and humidity is, or ask Tato what the temp and humidity is. And it's like, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I can't do that with, I know with my Ecobee thermostat, I can't get that information via the Echo skill. And I don't even think I can get that out of the Nest either. It's limited, though. And it's frustrating when you know that the data is available. And the way it all works is these Echo units talk to the Echo Cloud, and then that talks to whatever cloud it is that manages your other things. So they're not, I think even with your Wink bulbs, it's talking over the cloud, not,
yes.
Okay. So it's not talking directly to them in your home. And that's a little bit, that's where things start to get a little weird. These have to be internet connected devices, right? So you could, if I had your Wink app running here at my house, I could control your lights from here. Is that right?
As far as I know, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So that's,
you have to sign in with my ID, and then it's like, oh yeah,
that's right.
I know this device.
Yeah. So when you're, but that's sort of the other nice part is if it has a cloud service, it is almost certainly, you know, compatible with the Echo ecosystem, even stuff that's really, really old. And that's not always the case with Siri. In fact, it's almost certainly not the case. And I'm sorry I said S-I-R-I. I always forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, I've been really happy with it. We've got it hooked up to our Harmony remote. So I can say, hey, turn on the TiVo or turn on the Apple TV, and it will, you know, configure everything nicely. I can even have it pause, because our Harmony remote will do this, I can even have it pause our Sonos in the living room when I tell it to turn on the TV. So it like becomes this, you know, kind of scripted environment. And then I think, as I mentioned on a recent show, I went a little nuts and set up a little Node.js based Sonos controller here at the house. So now we can do what Sonos and Amazon have promised is coming next year, which is we can control our Sonos via voice. And I will tell you, that is stellar. Now, if you don't have Sonos and you're just listening to music on your Amazon unit, then you can do that now. And once you've experienced that, it absolutely makes all the sense in the world to just be able to say, you know, hey, tell Sonos to make it louder, or hey, tell Sonos next track, or hey, tell Sonos, I want to, you know, to play, you know, Frank Zappa in the kitchen, and boom, it just, it's like, okay, no problem. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now here's one that was unexpected, but I really like. So the Eero has a skill. I'm like, well, why would you need a skill for the Eero? I mean, it's a Wi-Fi mesh thing.
Yeah.
The thing is, you can name them when you set them up. And here's the fun part. You can ask it to find things for you. So, for example, I can say, whatever, ask Eero to find my iPhone. And it's like, the last I saw your iPhone was next to whatever the name of the nearest Eero access point is.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. And actually, they recently enhanced their iOS app to also dig in and give you a little more detail about what's connected to each point.
Right.
So you can kind of understand what's happening. That's a neat skill. I also got a Wemo skill because somebody, a secret admirer, got me a Wemo.
Oh, nice.
It's just a power plug.
Yeah.
But you name it. And so, for example, right now I have it hooked up to one of my humidifiers. So all I have to say is turn on the humidifier, and it's like, okay.
Yeah, that's it. I think we're just gonna say hey. We're not gonna say a name, hey. And that's how we're gonna do it in the show. So hey, turn on the humidifier, because you can do that with. I mean, you can't. You have to say the name, but that way we're not triggering anything. You know, here's the thing. Right now, and again, you know, depending on when you listen, these prices might change. But the Echo Dot is normally only $50 from Amazon. Right now, it's only $40. So, you know, for $40, this is kind of when I got one for me a couple of months ago, it was just like, well, you know, it's $40. I'll play with it. And instantly I was hooked. So and so is the whole family has been hooked. It's great. Just setting time. I mean, we use it all the time, setting timers in the kitchen. It's like, hey, set a timer for 10 minutes. But what's cool, and you can't do this with the Apple stuff, you can say, hey, set another timer for 7 minutes, and it'll keep track of multiple timers, which, again, seems so simple. But in the kitchen, man, when your hands are full, it's awesome to just be able to interact with, you know, Skynet like this without having to do anything. So it's cool stuff. I will say having an Echo unit has made me use Apple's stuff in my phone more, especially when I'm driving. I'm more used to just interacting via voice. So in the car, I'll say, you know, hey, read me my messages or whatever. And then it does. And that process tends to work fairly well. So that's cool stuff. We'd love
weirdness.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, the only weirdness I've run into is a couple of times. So I have it in the same, what I call my entertainment center. And I watch a good amount of movies.
Sure.
And more than once, it's responded to something that was said in the movie because I think it thought someone was talking to it. Like at one point, I was watching a movie and all of a sudden I hear, my pleasure. And I'm like,
yeah.
What? And then I'm like, oh, okay. You were responding. I think if you say thank you, it'll give you if you thank the device, it'll give you one of many replies. And one of them is my pleasure. And now the other cool thing is that their app will show you what it thought it heard, and you can help them make their system better. So, for example, last night when I was watching, it was a Sully, pretty good flick, actually.
Ah, cool.
But yeah, I have a phrase in here, and I don't know what it thought was being said, but the phrase here, it says, will be fought with is in a human ours on games. And I'm like, wow, whoa. Where'd you get that from? Huh. So I basically, and for a lot of things, you can say, was this what you said? And you can say, no.
Right. That's right.
And for that one, I'm like, I didn't say that.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
So it's worth going and getting one of these things. They're fun and a relatively inexpensive. And there are Easter eggs in them. So we will end this little segment.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We will end this little segment by saying the following, and perhaps and this is just because I went and saw Rogue One last night. So so I'm just going to share a little bit of that with you. But no spoilers. Don't worry. I'm just going to say this. Alexa, I am your father. And we'll leave it at that. I had a weird network issue. We've been talking a lot about mesh networks, and we're not going to dig back into familiar territory quite yet. We will. We'll get back there. But I had an interesting issue. Last week when we recorded this show, John and I were having some network weirdness between the two of us. And I immediately, of course, blamed it on John. And what we were seeing was not necessarily a ton of packet loss, but weird latency and just inconsistent latency. And so we both started doing ping tests, and we were pinging things outside of our network. We were both pinging www.apple.com. Just open up a terminal, type ping space www.apple.com and let it roll. And what's nice is you can kind of watch that and see, do you miss any packets, or does the time, the turnaround time, which is reported in milliseconds, change dramatically? And I figured, you know, we'd watch that. And so when we were having problems, we looked, and unfortunately it was on my end. I saw, you know, instead of it being normally it's like 20 milliseconds, it was up at like 70 or 80 as like a baseline, and occasionally would spike to 200 or 300. It's like, all right, what's going on? And then it would get better. So we did the show, and I didn't think much of it. And we had some weird things happen at the house over the weekend. Again, just couldn't quite be explained. Everything sort of worked. That was the problem. And then middle of the week, I did a speed test from my office, and I was getting 2 megabits a second in each direction. That's right, John. 2 megabits. Yeah, and I'm like, oh, okay, this is a problem. So I did a test inside the house, a speed test, inside my network from my iMac in the office to the router, actually. Using iPerf because the current router that I have set up lets me SSH in, and I can run iPerf on it, which is great. And again, I was getting like 2 megabits a second. I'm like, oh, crap, something happened to the Ethernet cable buried between the house and the office. Like, this is bad news because the ground's frozen now. Like, this is not going to work. And so I did a test up to the studio here to make sure that within the office, everything was fine. It wasn't just the Ethernet cable on my computer. Yep. That was, you know, full gigabit speed, 980 something megabits. Okay. And then I thought, wait a minute. Now let me do a test to the point of entry in the house. And I got 900 megabits to there. Like, okay, sweet. The buried cable is good. And I isolated it down to, basically something behind the TV in our master bedroom, which is sort of one of the hub points in my home. And I knew that from there, between there and the run that goes to the router, which is clear in the other end of the house, which is over Mocha, that's where the problem was. So I thought, all right, maybe my Mocha adapters need to be reset. So I reset them. Nope, same problem. I dug around and I found it. I found an Ethernet cable, the one plugged into my Mocha adapter, between the Mocha adapter and the switch, had been chewed. We have a new cat, new to us cat. They tell us she's about 3 years old. She acts like a kitten. She looks like a kitten. I think she's a kitten. They say she's 3 years old. They're lying. But anyway, she's been chewing all kinds of cables. It's been our nightmare for the last couple of months. We've completely depleted our supply of lightning cables and all of that. But so I was like, okay, great. And I'm like, man, so I swapped out the cable, problem instantly solved. Okay, great. And I'm looking at this cable. I sent you a picture of it. I even posted one in our Facebook group. I'm like, this is impressive because this cable, of the 8 wires that were in there, 3 of them were obviously completely severed and the others were well chewed. I'm like, man, Ethernet's really robust. Like, this is amazing that it was passing traffic consistently, not quickly, but consistently. Like, that's amazing. And one of the commenters, I think it was Graham McKay on Facebook, said, I wonder if, you know, this cable really wasn't any good and just Dave's crazy network at home, you know, self-healed and fixed it. And at first I was going to reply and say, haha, that's awesome. And then I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? He's totally right. Because I've had a mesh network in my house for years. And that mesh network is Sonos. The way Sonos works, when you don't have it just connected to your Wi-Fi, when you have it create its own mesh, which was the only way to do it for a long time, so that's how I still have it, it creates its own mesh. Now, that mesh is only officially built to be used to transmit data for the Sonos devices to each other. But it is built using standard network protocols, and specifically one called Spanning Tree Protocol, STP. And what STP does is it makes sure that when 2 devices are connected via 2 different paths, that there is no loop. And the way it does that is it sends packets, STP packets, out all the ports. And it waits, and they kind of hold an election about who's going to be the master. And then everybody reports back to the master. This all happens automatically. It's great. Everybody reports back to the master. Here's the quality. And it's basically, you know, ping times, but there's some other things they look at, I think. And they say, okay, what's the best path for me to get, you know, to you? And then what's the best path for you to get to point C and all of this? And they hold these elections and then they block everything except STP packets on the deprioritized ports. And that way, no loop happens, right? So if you've got, you know, A connected to B and B connected to C and C connected to A, they'll hold an election to make sure that C is not getting traffic from both A and B, right? You know, it's all going to go the right way. And because I have 2 Sonos devices plugged into Ethernet, STP is a very important part of my network. And And when this cable got chewed, I have no doubt that the Sonos devices said, well, we can't go that way. Got to reroute. This is a lower quality link, but it's all we got. So they just used it automatically. So mesh to the rescue, John.
I would be curious. So you've taken that cable out of your yeah. equation.
Yes. I mean, I still have the cable. No, actually, I threw the cable away. Yeah.
Oh, because I'd be curious what you would see. So there's something on the Mac called Network Utility.
Uh-huh.
And then there's an info tab. And then there's the various network interfaces. If you can get that cable back, I'd love to see what the values are. So if you click on each interface, it'll give you various interesting statistics.
It's zero. There's no connection. Lights.
Oh, there's none.
No. Okay. That's what impressed me at first. It was like, gosh, there's not even a link light on the switch that it's plugged into. I'm shocked that it's passing traffic. Of course, it wasn't passing traffic. So, yeah.
Okay. Because this information screen will show you the MAC address, the IP address, but then it shows link speed and link status, and I'd be very interested.
Yeah, no, there was nothing. It was okay. As though there were no cable plugged in because it was severed. Yeah, no, I saved it at first because for exactly this reason. I was like, I got to test this and figure out what it was doing, but okay.
So if you looked at the status screen, the link status in all likelihood would have been inactive.
Inactive.
And link speed would have been zero.
No, that's exactly what it was. Yeah. Yeah, it was just down. Yeah, it was no good, but it was pretty cool. And so I mentioned this story, A, because it's just fun and we're geeks and it's our last show of the year. So we're taking a little liberty and just having a geeky conversation that we might otherwise have offline. But many, not all, but many smart switches and even some routers, you'll see a lot of Netgear routers have an option in their advanced settings for enable or disable spanning tree protocol. And when you say disable STP, a lot of times, and this is the default on a lot of gigabit switches right now, they will block the STP packets. And I had this problem with the Netgear R8500 router. It was blocking STP packets for me because the switch that they bought from Broadcom and, you know, just soldered into the thing by default blocks them. I can't even fathom why you would want to block STP packets, but not everything else. I guess it is sort of chatty because it's constantly sending out this stream of packets. But having those blocked, the problem is it doesn't get there. So Spanning Tree Protocol doesn't know that there's a link. It assumes there's no link if its packets don't get there. And then it creates awful loops. And I was having a major problem because my Sonos system was causing a loop. And I finally figured out how to turn it on the switch. And I think now it might even be on by default because I yelled at Netgear. But I mentioned this because it might be one of those things I would advise turn it on every time. Because you might intentionally create a loop as a backup. You might also just be like me and create one because you're not thinking about it. And it's not a bad idea to kind of let the network, you know, do what it's supposed to do. But it's cool. You can see the STP packets if you use Wireshark, John. You just, you know, fire it up on whatever interface you're on. You do this on your Mac, and then you can filter in Wireshark. You can go to the top of the screen there because it'll just be a big, long stream of packets. But if you filter by STP, it'll slow it down. And what's cool is you can see it kind of electing different routes and stuff. If you have it plugged in and you have it monitoring, then you, like, turn off an Ethernet port or unplug the Ethernet cable or plug it in. Like, you just see things, and it's actually kind of cool. It's cool. I don't know. So Andy in the chat room is saying, generally in a corporate network, you would disable STP on all the ports except the trunk ports, the one port between the switches, which I guess makes sense. I can see why you would want to do that. Limit the clients from having to deal with all that traffic and just let the switches, the ports on the loop, do it. So, yeah, I can appreciate that. Anyway, so that's fun. I don't know. You had while we're in geek mode, can we just stay here? It's kind of fun. I hope you folks don't mind John and I taking a little liberty here on what will be this Christmas Day show, just having a geek chat. You had a little problem.
Well, I don't know if it's a problem. It's just a mystery.
All right.
So I was looking at my Mini, And I've seen this happen on both of my machines. So I run iStat menus, and one of the things that you can have displayed in the menu bar is the speed that you are reading from or writing to your hard drive. It's like, okay, well, that's kind of neat.
With iStat menus.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
And I noticed on one of my machines, or on both of them, all of a sudden I saw a spike in the read, and I'm like, huh, well, that's kind of weird. What's going on here? So, you know, you click on the menu,
yeah,
and it'll show you processes and their read and write speeds. And there's one called Apple SSD Statistics. And it was churning at about 20 megabytes a second for several seconds, and then it just kind of went away. And I'm trying to figure what the heck it is. Are they collecting performance information from my machine and then sending it back home? The thing is, I found, I dug around and I even found the program.
Yeah.
So it's actually in slash, here's a fun one, slash user slash USR slash libexec. If you look in that directory, you'll find this command called Apple SSD statistics. With many commands, if you type man in the terminal and then a space and then the name of the command, it'll say, oh yeah, here's what this does. This doesn't do that. And even running it from the command line and then trying to put, you know, like a slash question mark or a dash V or a lot of command line programs. Well, a lot of them, if you just type the program without any arguments, it'll say, oh, well, here's all the switches or options or whatever that will make me do different interesting things. That didn't happen. Huh. And I also tried, you know, dash V. Sometimes it'll give you the version number, or dash H will give you help, or dash question mark or slash question mark. Depends on the program.
Yeah, right. Right.
I don't know what the heck it is. I'd love to know. I've seen scattered reports online of people saying, hey, this thing's, you know, taking... It was mostly people complaining it was taking processor. In my case, it wasn't taking any significant amount of processor, but it was doing some sort of dance with my SSD.
Was anything else? Is it possible that everything that happens to your SSD goes through this? So it was more of a red herring that it was reporting activity, but really it's just monitoring the activity. So activity monitor erroneously reports that it's Apple SSD statistics versus something else, right?
Well, both iStat menus and activity monitor both,
I know,
showed it being responsible for a certain amount of data being moved around.
All right. Well, right. I am testing. Oh, wait a minute. That's the wrong drive. Hang on. All right, so I've got this thing up in what do we call it? Activity monitor, right? And I'm just gonna go to my home folder here and go to like downloads or something. Okay. So I'm gonna run Blackmagic speed test here on my SSD. Hopefully I don't break anything that we're doing for the recording. And no, I'm not seeing anything that shows this. So no.
Yeah, and I don't see it now in my process list. So I don't know what causes it to wake up and what it's doing. If anybody knows.
So I wanted to look more at it. And in Activity Monitor, when you go to double click it, you get the memory and statistics tab, but you don't get the open files and ports tab. And the reason is because it's launched as root. So you can't see that because when you run Activity Monitor, you're not running as root. However, that's a solvable problem. So I just went to the terminal and I typed sudo space and then I dragged the Activity Monitor app and did a little bit more. So it's sudo. I'll put it in the notes, but you kind of dig in and run Activity Monitor as root by pointing at the Activity Monitor app in the terminal. I'll put the command in the thing because it's a pain in the neck to read. And so now I can see open files and ports because I'm running Activity Monitor as root. Ain't much there. So we get, like you said, user libexec, Apple SSD statistics, user lib dyld, private var db dyld, dyld shared cache, dev null, dev null, dev null, and then k count equals one in a state.
Oh, okay. I'll have to try that.
So there's nothing more. There's nothing there, unfortunately. Yeah, I know. It's a little weird. Oh, well. Yeah. I don't know, man. That's a head scratcher.
Yeah, well, maybe someone can help us.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun stuff.
What you doing, Apple? What's going on?
What's the app doing? Yeah. It's fun. I like digging into stuff like this. It's good. All right. Let's see. Is Lewis's question too much like what we just talked about? Should we save that for another week, John, or is that a good one?
I think it's worth discussing.
All right, let's go.
All right. So, Louis.
I believe you're right. I believe it's Louis. That's right. Yeah.
Right. Hi, guys. I'm looking into changing my home network setup, and my main goal is to reduce clutter and hopefully increase overall network speed. I have the following setup. First device is a Bell router provided by the ISP. And it has four ports, and plugged into that are an iMac, a disk station, a Netgear Orbi, and an unmanaged green gigabit switch. Then we have the Netgear Orbi wireless router, and that has four ports connected to a Sonos hub, a SmartThing hub, a printer, and the Bell router. And then the third device is an unmanaged green gigabit switch, which is connected to a Mac Mini, which is a Plex server, a TV, I guess an Apple TV, a Wii. Oh, no, I see Apple TV as well. So you must have another TV.
Yeah, my TV's got an Ethernet port. Sure. Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right, so we have three devices here. And then the question is there any significant gain in network performance by investing in a gigabit Ethernet smart switch from Buffalo, for example, and centralizing all or most of the Ethernet connections to it? And the setup would be the Bell router connected to the smart switch, the Orbi connected to the smart switch, and the smart switch connected to everything else. And then a secondary question, what's the advantage of a green?
I'm going to, I want to say one thing before we get into this. I am assuming that in this scenario, the Orbi is not set up as a router and instead is set up just as a bridge mode device that is creating wireless.
That is my assumption as well.
Because if it's not, you've created a disaster, right?
Yeah. Well, then you're going to get a double NAT kind of.
No, it's not even double NAT because the Orbi and the switch are at the same level. Right. So I don't know what you would get. Yeah, it would be at best it would be double NAT, but I don't think that's the case. It sounds like the Bell router is the router and the Orbi is in bridge mode. He just didn't mention that. It came up as a red flag for me. So we are going to assume that the Bell router is the only thing acting as a router here. And for the sake of our conversation.
Right. So the answer to the question, could you get better network performance by changing things? And the answer is yes. Why is that? Well, I'll use the one that I have as an example here, Dave. So I have the TP-Link TL-SG108E, which is a dandy little 8-port gigabit. They call it a smart switch.
Sure.
Now, here's the thing with a switch, or at least what should be the case. So it's a gigabit switch. So each port on this goes at a gigabit. But here's the other important thing about a switch is that you'll see it referred to under different terms. What a switch should be able to do is allow full speed connections between all of the devices plugged into all of the ports. So what does that mean? Well, at least in the case of this one here, if you look at the specifications for it, it'll say, oh, well, my switching capacity is 16 gigabits per second. Well, how do we come up with that number? Well, I'll tell you how. There's 8 ports on it. Each one's a gigabit. And you can talk in two directions, full duplex. Well, that's 8 times 2, 16 gigabits per second, right?
Of course. You know, I never stopped to think about it. But of course that makes sense. Yeah.
Now the thing is any switch worth, I suppose it's possible to design a switch that doesn't have a backplane that can handle the full bandwidth. And in which case I wouldn't buy it.
Although the chances that you're going to be using full bandwidth on a Switch are pretty slim. It like you said, it shows that they've cut a corner. What other corners did they cut that we don't know about? Is kind of the question I would ask.
Huh. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now here's the problem, though, is that if you have multiple devices, the thing is, you can daisy chain network devices or connect one to the other. But then here's the problem is that the connection between any two of the devices turns into a potential bottleneck. Right.
Right. Yeah. Because you're going switch to switch or anything like that. That's right.
Right. So the thing is, if you have a whole bunch of devices connected to one switch and then they want to blast data to a device on another switch, the problem is the bottleneck is going to be that one. So in this case, you have a gigabit connection between your various network devices or switches. That's going to be a bottleneck if devices on one switch all want to, you know, communicate at full speed with devices on the other side. Because you got this restriction here.
Yeah.
So in general, the answer is yes. You want to. You would get optimum network performance by having everybody or as many devices as possible plugged into a single switch.
Yeah.
And that's my answer, and I'm sticking to it. Now the green thing, you know, is I don't know. I mean, even the one that I have advertises it's green. And I looked, and the maximum power draw is 48 watts, which is, you know, an old style light bulb. So, I don't know. To me, that's not a significant factor because to me, you know, 48 watts, and it goes into a low power mode when there's things not happening.
When there's things not plugged in or things not happening. I feel like the my reason for choosing a green switch is a most of them in sort of in the price range that we're talking about are that way anyway. And two, heat, right? Because I'm probably going to stuff this thing somewhere that isn't optimal for, ventilation or cooling. So if it's green, maybe it's going to generate less heat when I'm not doing a bunch of stuff. And that's a good thing. I recently did pretty much what Louis's talking about here. I had kind of that Frankenstein setup of a bunch of different little like 4, 5, and 8 port switches all, you know, wired up together. And it looked lovely, I'm sure. But I consolidated and in the office, and then I bought two of these things, one in the office and one behind the main TV in the house, which is where the main router is and lots of stuff plugged in. I bought two TrendNet 16 port gigabit green switches, and they're $60 a piece at Amazon right now. So that seems cheap to me for a 16 port switch, and they've both been running great. No problems with them, easy access. They're just big square blocks or big rectangular blocks, and they work. I don't know what else to say. They're not smart switches. I don't need them to be smart switches. I have no. There's really no benefit to me for that here. I just need stuff to talk to each other. That's it. So,
yeah, the reason I would look at a switch that's more than a basic switch, Dave. So we've been talking a lot about how there's been a lot of advances in Wi-Fi, you know, multi-user MIMO and stuff like that. Things that try to do the right thing as far as giving you the bandwidth that you need. A regular off-the-shelf switch just kind of wings it. And if it gets saturated, like we mentioned, you know, it is possible to saturate it, then it does the best. I don't know, round robins or whatever. I guess that's would be the normal way to, you know, deal with that is, okay, well, you know, everybody wants to, you know, get this data through this, you know, restricted channel. Well, the best I can do is kind of round robin it for you. Okay.
Sure.
A smart switch, or at least the one that I have here, and I'm sure the Buffalo and others do that. The nice thing is that they give you. Typically, we'll give you a level of control, and I think we talked about this in a past episode, is that I can set up QoS.
Prioritize different devices or whatever.
And you can prioritize, and it depends on the vendor. I'm not familiar with Buffalo's, though I believe you've dealt with theirs as well. But you could say, okay, whoever's on this port, I'm going to limit your speed to this. Right. Or if it's this type of traffic, then allow full speed. If it's this type of traffic,
Yeah, feel free to deprioritize or whatever. Yep.
And you can do other things like this one. It'll actually test the cables, which I think is kind of cool. So actually, you would have benefited from having one of these smart switches because it would have told you, dude, your cable's shot. Because this thing actually goes out and electrically will tell you, oh, okay, well, I think your cable is about this long and it's working okay. It's really neat. So
cool.
I guess that's all I have to say about that. So get a switch with as many ports or more ports than you think you need. I'm actually in a situation now, Dave, where I'm actually doing what I told you not to do, which is I actually have my smart switch daisy chained to a dumb one. Though the thing is, what I did is I plugged in relatively low speed devices into the dumb one. I plugged in my printer and I don't even know what other device, but things that don't take up a lot of bandwidth. So I it'll be highly unlikely that I'm going to saturate, you know, the channel between this switch and the other one.
Yeah.
I am thinking of getting a 16 port one.
I recommend, well, if you want a smart switch, this isn't it. But if you don't want a smart switch for $60, man, golden. So, all right. What else do we have here? We're going to talk about Todd here. And I think it might even be the same Todd that we talked about a little bit earlier. Todd said in episode 635, you said your iTunes library is on your Mac, but you also clone it weekly over to your NAS where it's used as a network media source. I'm thinking of moving my iTunes library to a NAS without also keeping a master on my Mac to reclaim the space on my SSD. Then to use iTunes, I'd of course need the NAS to be mounted. That's correct. He says, I have three questions. Number one, what does iTunes do if the NAS is not mounted and the library isn't found? Number two, since I have a MacBook Pro, I might be outside my house and outside my home network, and I want to use iTunes. I heard you talk about ways to connect to a NAS from the internet. Synology's Quick Connect, easy but limited to using the web interface or a VPN so that I can connect in the Finder. How can iTunes reach the NAS from the internet? And number three, how does moving my iTunes library to a NAS and pointing iTunes there differ from using an iTunes server on the NAS? Okay, so number one, iTunes will run if it can't find your library. As long as it can find, if it can't find your media files, as long as it can find your library files. So my advice would be move your iTunes media folder to a network drive and leave the iTunes library files. There's a couple of them on your Mac in sort of the normal configuration. That way, if iTunes launches and it can't find the library files, then it will just create, I think it might complain, but it might not. It might just going to open the default. It might create them and open the default library. So definitely do that. For connecting from outside of the house, connecting through the web interface is not going to do it because you effectively need the Finder to be able to see this stuff in order for iTunes to also see it. So you'd need to use a VPN to connect through. This starts to enter into what I would call non-optimal territory for sure. And then but we'll talk about that in a minute. And the difference between having your iTunes library, iTunes pointing to your library on the NAS and having an iTunes server on the NAS is control. When your NAS publishes its library as an iTunes library, you can play music from it and you can see playlists and all of that stuff, but you can't control it. You can't do anything about it. You're just seeing it as a shared library. So it's one-way access. Whereas if you store your library there, it's just like you store it locally, except it's over there. And now you have two-way access. I would not recommend doing this with a portable computer that you're going to try and access from outside where you're going to try and access this library from outside the house. I think you're going to wind up in a world of hurt. And using Apple Music, although I know that now we're talking about $10 a month, $120 a year expense, is built for you to do exactly this because now all your music is stored on the cloud and you don't need to you don't need to store copies locally on your Mac. And so that's kind of where I would go with this, trying to connect. And if it's only going to happen once or twice a year where you're going to try and connect to your iTunes library from outside the house, no problem. But if it's during the year, if it's every day or kind of that kind of thing, no, I wouldn't do it. You're making all kinds of noise over there, John. What do you have to say?
Nothing. I don't know why you're picking up all this noise today.
You're like humming and huffing and chair moving and it's all kinds of stuff. any thoughts on this?
No.
Okay.
No, I pretty much, stream my music just in the house. Don't really, if I had to do it, yeah, I probably would. You know, there's various things, you know, audio station, I guess, is one, at least in the Synology case. I think they offer an iTunes server, and if you wanted to, you could VPN in and do all that great stuff. But yeah, you brought up some good cautions there about how you could get into a non-optimal world.
Yeah, definitely non-optimal. That's, All right. Let's see. Do we have time for one more? Yeah, sure. Quickly. Because this has kind of become a little bit of the, you know, networky-ish show. So we'll talk about Brian's question very quickly. He says, he just bought an Eero. He says, I currently have an Airport Extreme at one corner of my house, with power line connecting it to an Airport Express in the middle. I've been considering replacing them with an Eero system. I'll also be adding a Synology DS1515 Plus to my equipment and putting it in my office on the second story. Both airports are on the first floor. Since I don't have Ethernet cable in the walls and power line is speed limited, would placing an Eero in my office about 20 feet away from the Fios entry point and connecting the Synology to its Ethernet port instead of power line be a practical alternative speed-wise? The initial Eero is in the bedroom, and I'd like to avoid putting the Synology in the bedroom because of noise. Our Ethernet is 25 plus, or our internet is 25 plus megabits up and down in a Fios system installed by Verizon. Okay, so the short version is, yeah, this should work just fine. And you would do exactly what you talked about. You'd set up the Eeros in their normal wireless mesh and then plug the Synology into one of the two Ethernet ports on kind of the remote Eero there. And it would be on the network. And yes, that would work. There are lots of people doing that. I actually have my brother set up on a system where he's doing something similar. And it works just fine. But because you have the power line adapters, I would test it. I would use iPerf on your Mac, and we'll link to an article that shows you how to do that. But it's very, very straightforward and simple to use iPerf or iPerf 3 on your Mac to test speeds in both directions. And so I would plug your Mac into the Eero Ethernet wise at the base station, and then I'd plug it in again Ethernet wise at the Eero, you know, the remote Eero, test the speeds in both directions, and then do the same with Powerline. If Powerline is faster, then I would actually keep your Powerline there and plug the Eero in the bedroom, or not the bedroom, the Eero in the office into the Powerline, so that that now becomes your backhaul between the two devices. You just want to use the fastest backhaul that you can between them. And if that turns out to be the Eero's wireless link, which it probably will be, to be perfectly honest, I think the Eero is going to wind up being quite a bit faster than Powerline, especially at the distances you're talking about here. But it's worth testing it, especially if you already own the Powerline gear. There's no harm and a little bit of geeky fun and taking a minute and just figure it out. And then, you know, but either way, yes, it will totally work. If you decide that wireless is the best option, and it probably will be, that's totally going to work fine. Yeah. You know, latency is going to vary a little bit because it's wireless, but you're not going to have any problems. I think it's going to work totally fine. Thoughts on that, Mr. Braun?
I'm happy with my setup.
Yeah, right. It just works.
No power line in mind though.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Just three Eeros, a couple of wireless audio destinations, and they all work great.
Good. Cool. All right, folks. We hope that you've had a fun time here with us. We hope that you had a Merry Christmas or a Happy Hanukkah or whatever it is that you celebrate or don't celebrate. I hope you had a great Sunday, really, is what it all comes down to, and a great week in between as well. Feedback at MacGeekGab.com is where you can find us, and we would love to hear from you.
Right. And after you get done with your feats of strength, you can write to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
That's right. Feedback@macgeekgab.com, unless you're a premium subscriber, and then premium@macgeekgab.com is where you can find us, and we do prioritize those. Premium listeners that were featured in this show are Brian, most recently Todd, Louie, Douglas, who brought us down the Bluetooth rabbit hole, Larry, Gray, and I believe that's, and you right there. Thank you so much to all of you, everybody in the chat room too, at MacGeekGab.com/stream. Thanks to everyone. Really, it means a ton to have you as listeners. If this is our last episode of the year, because the next one will be released on January 1st. Yes, we'll be recording it ahead of time. Same kind of schedule, but released on January 1st. So send us your stuff, but we're paying attention all week and looking forward to hearing from you about all that stuff. John, thank you for another fun year doing Mac Geek Gab. It's a true privilege.
Oh, no, thank you.
See? Thanks to Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. Thanks to all our sponsors, especially Fat Cat Software, who sponsored this episode at fatcatsoftware.com/MGG. Gazelle at gazelle.com. Smile at smilesoftware.com. Squarespace at squarespace.com/MGG. Otherworld Computing at maxsales.com. Barebones Software at barebones.com. And Casper at casper.com. John, we ended this show, or we started this show in a non-traditional way with our odd intro. Uh-oh. And I'd like to end it in a non-traditional way, because we got a note this week that we have one listener that was speaking on behalf of all of you. And I want to share this because I think I know, in fact, because I've heard from lots of you that he is not incorrect speaking on your behalf. And so I would just like to thank this. It came in at a perfect time. Really meant a lot. John and I really appreciate it. So we're going to let Andrew take us out.
And g'day, John, and g'day, Dave. It's Andrew here in Bellingen on the east coast of Australia. I have some good news. I don't have any problems. I don't have any tips. I don't need any help. And best of all, I haven't been caught. But what I do want to do is, on behalf of your tens of thousands of listeners around the world, is wish you all the best for the Christmas and New Year period. And thank you for all of your support, guidance, encouragement, fun, rational thinking, crazy stuff, and everything else over the past 12 months. Speaking personally, you're my favorite 90 minutes of the week when it comes to geeking out. It's like having two mates over and sitting around a table and having a beer with them and talking about tech stuff. I absolutely love it. And even though I now live in my homeland of Australia, I've listened to you guys walking along the beach in Copacabana in Rio, Brazil, while traveling through the cradle of mankind in South Africa, while walking in Red Square in Moscow, while living in my hometown of San Francisco, and many, many other places throughout all continents around the world. You guys have been a travel companion for me over the last 10 years, and it certainly makes me feel at home geeking out with you. So have a great Christmas and New Year, and here's my wish for you in 2017. Don't get caught. See you guys.
Maynard.